Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Hello and welcome to If You Love This Planet. My guest today is Martin Seif, Chief Global Analyst for the daily online magazine The Globalist. For the past decade, Martin has been Chief News Analyst for United Press International and its former Managing Editor for International Affairs. He's received three Pulitzer Prize nominations for international reporting. He's the author of The Politically Incorrect Guide to the Middle East, published by Regnery in 2008, and Shifting Superpowers, the US-China-India Relationship in the 21st Century, published by Cato in 2009. From 1994 to 1999, Mr. Seif was chief foreign correspondent for the Washington Times. He was the paper's Soviet and East European correspondent, covering the collapse of communism for 6 years, from 1986 to 92, and for the next 2 years, he was its State Department correspondent. Mr. Seif has been a columnist for theglobalist.com since 2002 and has appeared as an expert on Asian security affairs and the Middle East on National Public Radio, the Fox News Channel, and C-SPAN. Martin Seif, welcome to If You Love This Planet.
Thank you very much. A pleasure and a privilege, Helen.
Martin, I'm always fascinated by your analysis. You wrote to me recently about the fact that you thought America was really adrift in its foreign policy. You referred to Iraq, Afghanistan. You didn't mention Pakistan. And in particular, you referred to Georgia and what's happening in Russia. So I think, Martin, see if we should start from there. I'd like you to explain to the audience, please, what the history of American involvement in Georgia has been, what it is now, and how the Russians are currently reacting to that.
Georgia is in the Caucasus. It's a small, landlocked republic. I know it well. Very beautiful, mountainous, forested. No significant natural resources of its own, but very significantly placed, Helen, between the Caspian Sea and the Black Sea. And the Caspian Sea is now the second most important source of hydrocarbons in the world. Sometime in the next 50 years, it will exceed the Middle East as the Middle East oil well fields run dry.
What, the Caspian, did you say? The Caspian?
Yes, the Caspian.
Yeah.
The countries that have most access to this, and the main oil fields are deep below the Caspian Sea itself. The key regions are controlled by three former Soviet republics, Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan, and Uzbekistan. Now, all the key communications routes out from there, and most of all the important gas and oil pipelines out from there, Russia has had a monopoly on them. But Western oil companies are trying to, and European ones more even than the U.S., are trying to break that monopoly, and the Russians don't want the monopoly broken.
Of course not.
Georgia became independent, along with all the other former Soviet republics, back at the collapse of communism in the end of 1991, beginning of 92. They've had presidents since then who alternated between being very anti-Russian, like the Zviad Gamsakhurdia, and the present incumbent, Mikhail Saakashvili, and being relatively pro-Russian and ready to accommodate the Kremlin. That was Eduard Shevardnadze, who many people will remember was the relatively liberal, reforming Soviet foreign minister in the time of Perestroika and Glasnost.
And Gorbachev. I met Shevardnadze. Lovely man. Most gentle face.
Which is why he's no longer president of Georgia. Helen, Mr. Saakashvili, who's there now, is a very idealistic, pro-NATO, pro-U.S. leader. The Bush administration loved him. Under President Bush, the U.S. funneled large quantities of aid to Saakashvili. All that aid ended up in Russian hands in August 2008, when the Russian army invaded Georgia and conquered a third of the country without batting an eyelid, within 48 hours.
Now, wait a minute. Why did they invade? There was a...
They've been at loggerheads with the Georgians, even with the relatively pro-Russian Shevardnadze, ever since he became independent. There were two breakaway... It's very complicated. The Russians have set up way back in the early 90s two breakaway regions within Georgia, south of Ossetia and Abkhazia, and virtually nobody in Australia or America ever knew the name. But it's like Sarajevo was before 1914. It's the kind of extremely obscure, out-of-the-way place
when you
that
can set
off a world disaster.
Yeah, Martin, when you say breakaway regions, what does that mean, that Russia encouraged those two regions to break away and be with Russia rather than with Georgia?
Yes, that Russia recognizes them as independent countries.
Yeah. Yeah.
Virtually nobody else, Helen, except very close allies of Russia, do. Georgia certainly does not. Georgia regards them as simply regions in rebellion.
Yeah.
The Russians have packed them full of weaponry, militia forces, and the Georgians accuse the Russians of using those two areas to try and destabilize Georgia in general. Now, because of international anger, the Russians pulled back from most virtually all the areas of Georgia. They invaded in 2008.
Why did they invade, Martin?
That's a good question, Helen. I think the long-term reason was to try and topple President Saakashvili and break the pipeline deals that he was making with Western Europe US-based companies. Because for Russia, control of oil and control of the transportation of oil and natural gas is power. The Russian economy would be in a shambles, but it's one success story over the past decade. And it's Prime Minister Putin's success story when he was president has been the building up Russia to be the dominant energy power in the world. Russia is one of the top two natural gas producers in the world. It was number one until thanks to the fracking revolution. That wasn't swearing, I hasten to add. That's
I
the
know.
Technical term. Yes, but many of your readers may not. And if this was
I
in the
love
UN,
the word fracking. I love
so
it.
So do I. So do I. And of course, I can't say that on any American talk show, you understand.
Let's all know that Martin, as you hear him talk, is Irish. So we're very similar. Irish, Australia is populated by Irish convicts, so our sense of humour is very similar.
Very, very much so.
So we both like
well
saying
know,
fracking.
Helen, exactly. Exactly. Now, Russia exports more oil and gas combined than any other nation in the world, including even Saudi Arabia. And whereas Saudi Arabia's oil reserves, while they're still very massive, the Saudis husband them very carefully, the Russians are still discovering new oil reserves. But part of their power is not just their own oil. As I say, part of their power is having a monopoly over the export of oil and gas from the Caspian republics, from the Caspian independent nations to the West. And the Western nations and Poland want to break that monopoly. The former government in Ukraine did, but it was voted out a year or so ago. And the new government in Ukraine has got excellent relations with Moscow, so they're ready to play ball with the Russians. They're not going to risk angering them on this issue. But President Saakashvili down in Georgia still wants those pipelines built. But there's a deeper factor involved.
Yeah.
Georgia, the Georgians are ethnically different, obviously, from the Russians. But Georgia was a part of Russia since Australia was founded.
Yeah.
It became part of the Russian Empire in the year 1800, and it was part of successive Russian and Soviet nations till 1991, till the end of 91. And, of course, the most terrible ruler in Russian and Soviet history, Joseph Stalin, was a Georgian himself.
Well, can I interrupt you here, Martin C?
Whenever you like. It's your show.
Well, years ago I went to Russia with an ex-CIA agent called Arthur Macy Cox and with Bill Coffin, an ex-CIA agent, on an AFSC delegation, a Quaker delegation. And we were taken to the Moscow Circus, and in came these magnificent-looking horses with men riding upside down under their bellies, and they were the most beautiful, most handsome men I'd ever seen. I was totally turned on by them. But I found out they were from Georgia. And I decided then and there I had to go to Georgia. So I came back and I went to Georgia and I took my daughter, who was then a beautiful, well, she still is, blonde medical student. And indeed, the men are absolutely gorgeous. And they do that crazy dancing, you know, where they dance with their arms crossed and down on their heels.
Yes, that's yes. right.
Yes. And but they all look like Stalin. The women weren't nearly as attractive or beautiful a la men, but we had a wonderful time and the food was to die for. It was just so beautiful. So that was my experience with Georgia. And of course, Shevardnadze looked very much like a Georgian man. So I just want to interject that sort of little anecdote as we're talking
actually,
about Georgia.
It's an important anecdote to put in because Georgians are like, you could say, Montenegrins. Serbians, Sicilians, parts of people from my native Ireland, in that there's a strong tradition of independence and of revolt against huge empires that occupied the country for very long periods of time. And always, eventually, local independence wins out. It's a very Polish type of story as well. But in the case of Georgia, there hasn't been a parallel development in the 20 years since national independence, except when Shevardnadze was president, of responsible statecraft. So what you have now is very difficult relations between the Kremlin, whoever's in it, whether it's President Medvedev or President Putin before him on the one hand, and President Saakashvili on the other. Now, when President George W. Bush was in the White House, the U.S. was just into expanding NATO and expanding the outer rim of NATO, you could say, nations that weren't yet in NATO, but that the U.S.
right up to the Russian border, really pissing off the Russians. And I don't know if I can say piss off, but I'm saying it. The Russians were so furious. And the other interesting thing here is, and I wrote about it in the New Nuclear Danger, my book, was to enter NATO, those poor little countries once or part of the Soviet Union, Eastern Bloc, had to arm to a certain level to become eligible to join NATO. And so Lockheed Martin ran around those countries holding big conferences, lobbying for the countries to buy their weapons so they would be eligible to join NATO. Did you know that, Martin?
No, I didn't.
Oh.
But I'll say this: there's a lot of arguments around that corporations pull strings on government, this, that, and the other. My experience has been very much the opposite. My observation in 25 years in Washington has been that governments take the most insane, especially U.S. ones, take the most insane policies for the most naive of reasons, and it usually bewilders even the largest corporations in the private sector, which have the relatively rational purpose of making more money for their stockholders
and killing more people, let's be frank, Frank.
Well, also saving lots too. Why? How was smallpox eradicated? You're a doctor, you know. The major American foundations, which are funded by the corporations, led the drives to find cures for polio. And
I'm not going to support the corporations in the military-industrial complex, Martin. No way.
Well, now, Helen.
No way, shape or form.
What happened in Georgia and Eastern Europe, though, wasn't driven by the American corporations.
No,
it was driven by ideology out of control in the
yep.
Bush administration.
Yeah.
Now, a lot of people, myself included, expected that when President Obama took office,
there
would be a more reined-in American policy. And in fact, the President and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton very famously announced that they would set a reset button for relations with Russia when they took office.
Yeah.
Now, in some respects, even in areas where I think it was unwise, they did this very thing. They effectively scrapped. They didn't say they were scrapping, but they de facto scrapped this the strategic missile defense program, which was interesting because it couldn't have, it couldn't have defended against the Russian strategic missile forces. But the Russians were furious about it anyway.
But they're putting it in Poland as we speak. I mean, Obama's about to visit Poland to set up part of the missile defense system.
You've gone ahead of me. Exactly.
Okay, sorry.
No, you're absolutely right. I'm glad you did, because that's the thing about the president. The president is accused by his enemies of being a very radical leftist.
Mm-hmm.
He is nothing of the kind.
No.
He's a moderate consensus figure, and in both good ways and bad ways, Every issue from keeping a massive American presence overextended around the world to running up record deficits at home, he's the natural continuation of the George W. Bush administration.
I agree.
I thought you would. I call them the B&O or the BO administration, Bush and Obama, because beneath the rhetoric, there really isn't that much to judge between them. Now, if the world could go chugging on in its current state indefinitely, one could be maybe more cynical or philosophical about it. But, of course, it can't. And for America's sake, it can't either. We're running these huge record deficits. We have the military involved in strategically unwinnable wars in Afghanistan. We haven't pulled out of the war in Iraq. The semi-war in Libya has turned out just to be a bloody fiasco. Bloody in both the literal sense as well as in the expletive sense of the term. Of course, I don't have to tell you this. But we see the same pattern in Georgia, where it's enormously dangerous. Because if you read the pattern of coverage in the Russian media that preceded the 2008 war, and you read the general pattern of coverage in the Russian media, the Russians are a great and proud nation. They're very much in the position that Germany was in the late 1920s, early 1930s. A sense of having been shamed and outwitted and even betrayed by the West.
And shafted.
Yes, exactly. There's a key point here that virtually everyone has forgotten. And that is that when the Soviet Union was disintegrating, President George Herbert Walker Bush, the older President Bush, and his Secretary of State, James Baker III, both assured President Gorbachev of the Soviet Union that they would honor the disintegration of the Soviet Union or the revision of the Soviet Union into democratic structures. And in response, the United States would never allow NATO to expand to include the former nations of Central Europe of the Warsaw Pact. Well, every former Warsaw Pact nation is now a NATO member state. And as you said before, we didn't stop there. Latvia and Estonia and Lithuania never wanted to be part of the Soviet Union. They were subject to virtually genocidal repression, as you know, when they were taken over a second time in 1940 by the Soviets. And then there was another slaughter when the Soviets reconquered them from the Nazis, and of course the Nazis had murdered everyone in sight too. So waves of bloodshed covered those countries. But from the Russian and Soviet perspective, they were member states of the Soviet Union itself, and yet even they were pulled into NATO. And the George W. Bush administration of the second and far less wise President Bush was even trying to bring Ukraine and Georgia eventually into NATO as full alliance members.
Oh, it's nuts. It's absolute nuts. And you know what? Russia wants to be part of NATO. Why, for Christ's sake, don't we include Russia in NATO? And then the whole thing would evaporate. I'll tell you why, Martin Seif. Because the military-industrial complex, it's still over $1 trillion of American taxpayers per year, want to ring Russia with bases and China, which they're currently doing, so they can keep making their bloody, and I mean bloody in both senses of the words, weapons.
Oh, I don't buy that. What I buy is a simpler and much more despairing explanation. Your explanation would be rational. But I do not believe our policy, as far as the policymakers go, is driven by fundamental considerations of financial profit or rationality.
What is it?
And President Obama, for example, I think he and others, they do it because they always do it. There was in 1914, or after World War I was over, Kaiser Wilhelm II, who certainly did have the power in Imperial Germany and loved to be called the All Highest, the imperial autocrat, claimed after the war that World War I wasn't his fault. He said there was this terrible militaristic machine and it ran away with me. Now, of course, the Kaiser was one of the main causes of the war. At the same time, once the war was about to begin, we know that the Kaiser, like Kennedy and Khrushchev in 1962, unlike people like Hitler or Stalin, the Kaiser did have elements of decency in him and was basically he was a blustering, insecure fellow, but he was basically sane. And at the very last minute, he tried to pull back from the brink. Now, in 1962, of course, as you well know, in the Cuban Missile Crisis, John Kennedy and Nikita Khrushchev were able to pull back from the brink. And it was very difficult to do so. There's an excellent book by Michael Zorbs, formerly of the Washington Post, I think called 5 Minutes to Midnight.
Well, let me tell you, I'm interrupting you again.
Go ahead.
I got to know Robert McNamara extremely well towards the end of his life because I held this symposium called 3 Minutes to Midnight about how close we are consistently to launching a nuclear war, you know, tonight or tomorrow morning by computer error or human error. And he and I used to go to some event, I think the Cosmos Club in Washington, for lunch when I was there. And he said to me, "Helen," he said, "you don't know how close we came." He was in the Oval Office. He said, "within minutes."
I have no doubt that's true. And I'm not a McNamara admirer, but I have no doubt that is absolutely correct. No doubt whatsoever. Yeah. And by the same token, right now, Russia has a larger active thermonuclear arsenal than the United States.
Yes, in terms of megatonnage.
Exactly. Yeah. There is no defense against the strategic missile forces. The only quote-unquote defense, or rather deterrence, there is no defense. No. The deterrence factor is what McNamara himself was a main creator of, and that's the MAD doctrine. As you know, mutually assured destruction. But during the Soviet era, American and Soviet leaders handled each other with great circumspection and care and respect because they didn't want, especially after the 62 Cuban Missile Crisis. Mm. Today, there is a complacency in the West and a bitterness in Moscow that is not understood in the West, certainly not understood in Washington. When I came to Washington 25 years ago, the finest talents in the American press corps were all found in Moscow. If you were going to be a star at the New York Times or the Washington Post or Time Magazine, that's where you went.
Yeah.
Today, instead, you'll sit in your cafes in Manhattan or DuPont Circle in Washington, and you'll blog witty witticisms. And you may comment once in a while about China or Tom Friedman's, I think, very witless line about the world being flat. It's true in the sense of us, of course, being in an interdependent world, but it's not true in the sense it's usually taken of a world that's, as you well know, it's equalizing where tensions are getting less. That attitude, I think, creates a desperately false state of security and comfort. We need to be dealing with the Russians and the Chinese, and for that matter, the Indians, but most of all with the Russians, with vastly more circumspection and respect. There is a great statement that Thomas Jefferson said at the end of his life about America's dealings with the British Empire that I think really should apply today to both Western Europe and the United States in our dealings with Russia. And that was in 1823, the Monroe Declaration was announced, which was a de facto strategic alliance between the British Empire and the United States, in which the United States agreed to cooperate with Britain to try and keep less liberal, undemocratic European influences out of the Western Hemisphere, out of the Americas. And the quid pro quo for the United States was that the British Empire basically would leave America alone, and the Royal Navy, which was supreme in the world, would basically give America strategic defense. Now, Jefferson all his life had been a bitter foe of Britain. He was the architect of the Declaration of Independence. If the British had captured him during the War of Independence, they would have hanged him. He had to run for his life. He supported the French Revolution against Britain. His sympathies were with France rather than Britain. And yet, after 50 years of these consistent policies, Jefferson reversed position to embrace alliance with England, with the British Empire, in the last few years of his life. He was already in his 80s, a very old man. And he was asked why. And Jefferson replied, and I paraphrase slightly, but anyone can look up this quote, you know, you just Google it, Jefferson and Monroe Declaration. Jefferson basically replied, "With England on our side, we can laugh at the whole world. But if England is against us, then our future survival is greatly threatened." That's not the exact words he used, being Jefferson. He was much more poetic and eloquent. But that was the basic idea. Now, today, for that reason, Jefferson would be a great champion of the revival of a genuine détente with Russia. But a genuine détente with Russia means that we have to make compromises with them as well as asking them to give compromises to us. I attended, as you know, I covered...
Well, first of all, let's interrupt you.
No, sure, go ahead.
My guest today is Martin Seif, who's the global chief global analyst for the daily online magazine The Globalist, but for the past decade, he's been the chief news analyst for United Press International. And as you can hear from Martin's accent, he's Irish and one of the most fascinating people I've probably ever met. So let's go on with the relationship of America with Russia, Martin.
Oh, by all means, Helen. Before George Kennan died, and Kennan, of course, was the architect of the containment theory.
Yeah, he was a friend of mine too, yeah.
Exactly. And as you know, one of the greatest and wisest political thinkers and analysts that the United States has ever produced,
yes,
certainly in the past century.
Yes.
And I heard him speak a couple of years before he died in Washington. And this was even before President Bush came into office. It was in President Clinton's era. And it was extraordinary what he said. George Kennan said that only twice in his long lifetime, and he was already well over 90 at that point, had he ever seen any nation which had the sublime confidence that had already teetered over into arrogance, that it could enforce its will anywhere in the world. And he said the only he wasn't making moral comparisons, I stress that, but he was talking in terms of the illusion that we had so much power that we could flick our fingers, basically, and create governments and create other societies based on our model wherever we wanted it, that it was right and proper that we should do so. He said the only two societies he had ever experienced and observed in his lifetime that where these attitudes had been so prevalent had been in the Soviet Union of Leonid Brezhnev in the 1970s, before Brezhnev plunged into Afghanistan in 1979. And he said the only other example was in Germany in 1940-41, when they had conquered France and most of continental Europe, and before Hitler launched his catastrophic invasion of the Soviet Union, Barbarossa.
And what was the question?
Kennan was not making any moral equivalent.
No, but what was he saying?
He was saying that the United States was capable of making the same kind of disastrous miscalculations that the Nazis had made in invading Russia and that the Soviet Union had made in invading Afghanistan, and for the same reason, that the rulers in the political, not just the rulers, not just the president or his secretary of state, but that the whole political culture in Washington, and remember, this was even before President the second Bush took office. He was saying this when President Clinton was still there, when Madeleine Albright was secretary of state. Kennan already saw that between Democrats and Republicans, between the neoconservatives of the Republicans and the people who are now regarded as the tough liberals, or the you know, the macho liberals, the muscular liberals in the Obama administration, that basically they were the same people, or they had the same attitudes, rather.
Towards what sort of attitudes?
That the United States was not just all virtuous, but, and had the solutions to all the problems of the world, but that we were all powerful and that we could and should basically impose our solutions by fiat on any part of the world where opportunity came up to do so.
Well, I'll tell you, Martin Seif, that I held a conference called, I think it was War in Heaven. It was about arming space, missile defense, and weapons in space. And we talked for 2 days at Ely House. I don't think you were there at the time, but, and I had people from both sides, pro and con. But the attitude of these people who wanted to arm the heavens, it's called the high frontier, was that America was just that, the most powerful, the most important country in the world that will rule by armaments, by force, and it was its absolute moral right and legitimacy to do so. And I was absolutely shocked to my back teeth. I'd never heard such absolute overt arrogance in my life, and it was revolting. But they didn't even see themselves as being revolting.
Exactly. I am not an America basher. I am not an America hater. I am convinced all my life and remain so that the United States has been and remains an overwhelming power for good in the world. But for that very, I'm also a student of history, and I'm a student of 20th century history. And my parents and extended family were survivors of the great catastrophes of European history and World War in the 20th century. Mm. So it's all too easy to see, even in my native Ireland, how history can go wrong. I mean, I was one of the idealistic young people marching for civil rights, which was an admirable cause, in the streets of Northern Ireland back in 1968-69. And in the end, the escalating tensions and conflicts that eventually developed from what were idealistic and well-meaning initial protests set off a cycle of civil war that wasn't fully tamed for another 30 years. And that was a very small-scale conflict, tiny-scale conflict. The British and Irish governments, bless them, made sure to contain it and acted very responsibly together to contain it. It was a model of, both Dublin and London proved models of responsible statesmanship in dealing with that.
Well, then, let's move on to where Russia is at the moment, because do you read Russian, Martin?
Yes, no longer well. I used to, but yes, I do read Russian.
Yes, so what is the Russian attitude now towards the United States in terms of its arming Georgia and its arming countries in NATO right up to the Russian border, in terms of putting a missile defense system in Poland and the like? How does it feel that it is not being included and is being specifically excluded the world community or the Western community by the United States specifically?
The Russians, first of all, have responded by basically, they are not isolated. They founded with China and the four of the five Central Asian republics in 2001, the SCO, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. Mm. They hold military exercises every year. They are virtually unreported in the American press. They are totally unreported in the American broadcast media or what passes for them. But more important than that, the general attitude in Moscow towards the West in general, but especially towards the United States, during the Soviet era, even when official publications like Pravda and Izvestia Helen, when I first traveled there in the 1980s, before Gorbachev took over, in the days of Brezhnev, Chernenko, Andropov, even when official relations were very poor with the United States, which was under President Reagan then, there was an undertone of warmth, civility, civilization, even admiration with the West. That changed in the 1990s.
Uh-huh.
And President Putin did not wave a magic wand or use a tyranny to impose negative attitudes on Russia. On the contrary, President Putin is a reflection of, an expression of, or he himself knows that he speaks for, a very widespread attitude in Russia, a sense of betrayal, and they believe double dealing by the West, because the privatization and democratization they went through in the 1990s was an ecological and demographic as well as an economic catastrophe for them.
Mm-hmm.
A small number of oligarchs locked up vast quantities of the wealth of Russia.
They stole
yes,
Russia's wealth.
And where do many of them now, most of them now live?
Disgusting.
In Britain and the United States. Even if you could argue that this is not so, the Russian people, by and large, perceive it as so.
Well, it is
so. This is very dangerous because there is a level of potential hostility and resentment towards the West, especially towards Britain and the United States, which policymakers in London and Washington are oblivious
to. Are they really?
I think they're totally oblivious.
And so what are you seeing reflected in the Russian press about these attitudes, Martin Seif?
Well, first of all, there is a consensus in Russia which is acted upon continually to keep Russia militarily strong.
Uh-huh.
It's a similar attitude, you can say, that Germany had before 1914, before World War I.
Uh-huh.
It's common in the United States especially to regard the Russian military as a joke. But they showed in their operations in Georgia in 2008 that they are not a joke. Now, the U.S. attitudes are, well, you know, we have such wonderful weapons systems and such a wonderful military that we could knock out the Russians in 5 minutes.
Oh, yeah?
Now, first I'm skeptical.
They could in half an hour and induce nuclear winter and the end of life on Earth, certainly.
Yeah, and the Russians would respond with even more nuclear retaliation if that happened, precisely. But even with conventional weaponry, the Americans don't realize. There is a book that came out more than 40 years ago, and I don't know if the author is still alive. I know he was in 2008, a very eminent British historian, who, interestingly enough, was a very strong influence on Margaret Thatcher when she was Prime Minister, called Corelli Barnett. He wrote a classic book in the early 1970s, Helen, called The Collapse of British Power, how the very fact that Britain was the global hyperpower in the 1920s and 30s was a source of weakness rather than strength, because British military strength had to be spread all around the world. So when war came, Britain might have been able to contain Germany by itself and had its hands full once Italy joined Germany. But once France fell, once Japan entered the war, as everyone in Australia knows, British power in the Pacific and the Far East disintegrated immediately. The British were overextended.
Yeah.
That's the advantage the Russians have over America now, but nobody in America
realizes it. In what way, then? How? Extrapolate
The United States is already fighting 2.5 wars. We still think
three and a half now with Libya, because in fact...
Exactly. And we have our defense commitments to Taiwan.
And Syria.
With the Chinese rumbling. Yes, exactly. And we still have our forces in South Korea and the commitments to defend South Korea. We have the alliance with Japan as well. We have the commitments to Israel. We have the commitments to Saudi Arabia and the Gulf oil states. And on top of that, we brought into the NATO, Latvia, Estonia, and Lithuania, which are genuinely democratic Western nations, but they're tiny little countries. Paul Wolfowitz was such an idiot that when he was he was notorious in the 1990s, before he even joined the Bush administration, for drawing up a plan to fight a full-scale conventional non-nuclear war with Russia if it was needed to defend Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia.
I know, but wasn't he the author of two such wars?
Yes, indeed he was. I mean, we wouldn't have gone into Iraq if he hadn't been there, and he and his friends hadn't pushed it. And you know one of the reasons they pushed it, Helen? One of the reasons he even... Bob Woodward has reported this, and neither Wolfowitz nor anyone else has challenged the account. Within 24 hours of the 9/11 terror attacks, Wolfowitz is telling President Bush, we shouldn't go after bin Laden and Al-Qaeda to get justice for these terrible attacks. We should invade Iraq and topple Saddam Hussein instead.
Now, why?
His argument at the time was because it will be easier.
But why did he... I don't understand why Wolfowitz, per se, would want to go into Iraq. Was it the oil?
Yes, and he was a close friend of Ahmed Chalabi, and he and his friends thought Chalabi would become president of Iraq, and Chalabi had assured them that there would then be a pro-American, Shiite, democratic Iraq, everything you want.
Crook. Chalabi wasn't curveball, was he? But I think he was close to curveball.
That is absolutely right. I mean, he didn't have to be curveball. Basically, the Wolfowitz people under Rumsfeld, easily the worst Secretary of Defense the United States has had.
A sociopath,
They went out overtime to try and distort intelligence. Yeah. And the interesting thing is, there was integrity and competence in the U.S. intelligence community. The CIA, the State Department, the Department of Energy, the Defense Intelligence Agency, all the leading experts from these major power sources in government, as well as the professional generals in the Pentagon, didn't want to invade Iraq.
No.
Or if Iraq had to be invaded, they pointed out what the problems would be.
Yep.
They were all correct.
Yep.
Secretary of State Colin Powell, who I think was a fine and very underestimated, Secretary of State.
Yep, I do too.
He and his people produced a 35-volume interagency report on all the problems the United States would face. From law and order to dealing with Islamist extremism to trying to prevent to rebuilding the oil infrastructure. They were right in virtually every detail. The report was totally ignored by Rumsfeld, with the full support of Vice President Cheney and President Bush. A handful of ideologues and plain idiots overrode the principled and professional warnings of literally thousands of serious full-time professionals in the U.S. Armed Forces, intelligence services, and diplomatic service.
Well, I'm looking. You see, I'm a physician, Martin, and when you have a patient with a disease, you must work out the cause of the disease, or what we call the etiology, before you can cure it. For instance, we couldn't cure or prevent infantile paralysis or polio until Sabine discovered the polio virus and developed the Salk vaccine. Now, what is the etiology of these crazy wars that America and in the past all nations have been involved in? The etiology is actually the psychology of these men. And I'm very interested in the etiology of war, why men kill. And I would actually diagnose Rumsfeld and Cheney and others, Wolfowitz, as sociopaths. Now, sociopaths are interesting. About 1 in 25 people are sociopaths in society. They're charming. They're highly intelligent. They get their own way all the time. They're sexy towards women. But they have no moral conscience. And they lie with impunity, and it doesn't impact them at all. They're no guilt. And I would think that these people are sociopaths, and in fact, they become so powerful that they rise to the top like cream and do others in on the way. They assassinate them psychologically. I mean, we see it all the time. And then they end up ruling the world, and they often are killers.
Go ahead, Helen. And I'm
very interested in why the whole of America is geared towards killing, spending over $1 trillion a year, whereas it has no decent medical care system at all. Why do we glorify killers? Why do we glorify war? Why is there a killer on a horse in every square in Europe? Alexander the Great was a sociopath. Napoleon, who killed hundreds of thousands of people in the name of France, has a tomb in Paris. Why do countries, is it a tribalistic trait related to when we were troglodytes that we glorify killers? Why do women fall in love with alpha males? They can't help it. I did when I was premenopausal. I think that all of this etiology, which is the cause of the whole thing, needs to be examined much more closely, and we must not be embarrassed to look at it. In fact, if we don't look at it, we're going to blow ourselves up. And as I speak, I would stress that there are 40 huge hydrogen bombs targeted on New York as I speak. McNamara and I wrote an article about that for the LA Times. 60 on Washington. Who are the real rogue states? Who are the real terrorists? Russia and America, who own 95% of the nuclear weapons in the world and threaten to blow up the world any second of any day. Here endeth my soliloquy.
I've traveled a lot in Russia. I have a great love of Russian culture, and I've had wonderful times professionally in Russia.
Too, yes.
Covering the Russia and the Soviet Union has been one of the main springboards of my professional career.
Yeah.
And I'm what they call a first American. I think in many respects you are too. I came to America. My wife and children are American. I love this country. And, of course, in World War II, the United States and the Soviet Union were crucial allies in eliminating a monstrous regime. Of course, Joseph Stalin's regime, it should have been even clearer at that time, was as monstrous in its own way as Hitler's. But when one looks at people like, I think there's another key point here. The people who I've observed in Washington over the last 25 years, the greatest war lovers are not generals.
Mm-hmm.
They are not warriors. They are not combat veterans. They are not people who've seen any kind of real war. Anyone who's been through any real war has paid the price for it.
Yeah.
My late father-in-law served in the U.S. Army, helped save Australia. He was with the Americal Division in New Guinea under MacArthur on the Kokoda Trail in World War II.
Mm.
And he suffered many episodes of post-traumatic stress and recurrent malaria.
They never get over it. They never recover. From seeing dead bodies and killing people. They never recover.
One of the things my wife and I always comment on is, it turned out, we didn't realize this till after my late father-in-law had long since passed away, but he would speak more freely with me as a son-in-law about some of those incidents, and I'm sure by no means the worst of them either, but just what the general experience was, than he had ever told his own children.
Mm.
And the reason, of course, I came to understand very clearly, it was precisely because he loved his family that he wanted to spur them the appalling experience that anyone in any serious combat situation experiences.
Yeah.
But there's a paradox here. If one looks at modern world and U.S. history, especially, and in the Soviet Union too, that many Nikita Khrushchev was one of Stalin's worst killers in Ukraine in the 1930s. And he fought ruthlessly through World War II as one of Stalin's top lieutenants. Yet, for all his bluster, he was a relative force for peace.
Yes.
When it became crucial. John Kennedy, of course, for all the scandals correctly associated with his name, had fought bravely in World War II in the U.S. Navy, had had his ship sunk under him, and had shown exceptional heroism in rescuing crew members. Mm. Kennedy and Khrushchev, in their different ways, knew how terrible real war was.
Yeah.
They had seen it firsthand. This made them more moderate. Powell is a classic example of this.
Yes.
He was a brave soldier, wounded and decorated for bravery in Vietnam. He saw Vietnam close up. People like him, or General Schwarzkopf, who successfully commanded in the First Gulf War, were not characters out of Doctor Strangelove. They were quite the opposite. We saw in the build-up to war in 2003 that this was the opposite of the Cuban Missile Crisis. And it was the opposite of the stereotypes of Dr. Strangelove. The generals of the U.S. armed forces were prominent among the forces of rationality and constraint. They obeyed and they operated the military.
Whereas the civilians are much more nutty.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, if you go back to the wonderful Flashman novels of the late George MacDonald Fraser, this is a recurrent theme. MacDonald Fraser, who wrote them, had been a combat soldier himself at the battles of Imphal and Kohima with the Anglo-Indian 14th Army in 1944 against the Japanese. It was one of the largest battles the Japanese Army ever fought in its entire history. And our current theme of MacDonald Fraser's fiction is hatred of the combat soldier, not for the enemy that he fights, but for the people back home in Britain wanting to expand the empire, being completely oblivious to the bloodbaths and suffering that are naively being inflicted in every direction.
And we've got a prime minister in Australia at the moment, bloody hell, God help us, called Julia Gillard, who has no experience in foreign affairs. One of our soldiers was killed yesterday in Afghanistan. And she said, you know, he is a noble man. He fought and died for noble heritage, that we're doing the right thing in Afghanistan. We will prevail. We're winning. A whole lot of absolute rubbish. And it's repeated again and again and again. These poor devils who get killed and slaughtered and maimed and torn apart. You know, this was a roadside bomb. They glorify them. And they fought for the country. That's rhubarb. We're not there for Australia. We're there because we're sycophants to the United States. That's why.
Or for someone, I'm American. I do not blame the United States. I advocate for our own prosperity and survival. I don't want to scrap the U.S. armed forces. I think it's a dangerous world out there. But the ideologies unstable ideologies.
Martin,
We are drunk on ideology in this country.
Yeah, we're drunk on ideology. No, but Martin, if we don't stop killing... And we've killed since we first stood on our hind limbs and developed the opposing thumb. If we don't stop killing, we're going to blow up the planet. There is no doubt about that in my mind. And I'm a very good doctor and a very good prognostician. The prognosis, I mean, apart from Fukushima, which is happening as we speak, we are going to use those nuclear weapons either by accident, by the Chinese hacking into the early warning system. We have to try and analyze why we have this instinct to kill, and we've got to do something about it. 53% of the world's people are women, and we sit back idly letting them in, you know, kill each other, and we fall in love with them, some of them, because they're strong. And there's a lot to be analyzed, and I'm not doing it very well at the moment because this time is short. But I would want to say, I would want you in the last remaining time that we have, Martin Seif, to please summarise where you think the United States is in regards to Russia and vice versa, not much of which is discussed in the American media or indeed the Western media at this time. Give us your analysis.
I think that it is one of the most important things in the world is for any administration in Washington, It doesn't matter it has to be democratic. It should be President Obama and Secretary of State Clinton's top priority. Mm. And I don't believe it's anywhere near their top priority to do more than give empty rhetoric to pressing reset buttons with Moscow.
Why? Because
the dangers of a miscalculation, especially over Georgia or regions in Eastern Europe or former Soviet republics, where the United States, where we are strongly supporting governments that are hostile to the Russians, and the Russian resentment of this is so great.
What is the danger?
There could be. It could deteriorate at some point into war between the United States and Russia. That
How?
Could go nuclear.
Yeah.
Oh, easily. I'll
describe
give you another
it.
Example.
Please describe it.
President Saakashvili is still in, for example, is still in a par in Georgia.
Yeah.
The Russians loathe President Saakashvili. If they were, God forbid, to assassinate him, or there were to be a coup, or President Saakashvili were even to announce something like the Jemison raid in the Boer War more than 100 years ago, if he were to approve some ill-advised attempt to destabilize the breakaway republics of South Ossetia or Abkhazia.
Within Georgia,
exactly. And the Russians would then regard that as a casus belli. How did World War I begin? It began with simply several bullets being fired by a teenage pimply loser, Gavrilo Princip, assassinating the Archduke Franz Ferdinand of Austria-Hungary and his wife. And as a result of that, the Austrian government, the military in the Austrian government, took this as a heaven-sent opportunity to crush Serbia as a nest of international terrorism.
So that
once
was a catalyst. It was a bit like that kid who was selling vegetables in Tunisia, and the government stepped on his toes about selling his vegetables, so he set himself alight, which started the whole revolution in many of the Arab countries. Just one catalytic situation could lead to the end of most life on Earth, right?
Yes, now nobody thinks of it in those terms.
Why not?
Because they are ignorant, Helen. Because they. You made a terrifying and, as I know, very accurate point before. Technically, according to the letter of the law, Russian missiles are theoretically not targeted on Washington or New York or any other American targets.
That's rubbish.
That's my point. You and I both know that simply by the press of a button, a single phone call, the necessary targeting information, which is always on hand, can be immediately put there. And one should also add that Russian thermonuclear missiles are far larger hydrogen bombs than American ones are, because the Russians have much greater trouble with targeting accuracy during long periods of the Cold War.
So you blow up a city with one huge bomb rather than America.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, look, Martin, can't you... I mean, why aren't you working why aren't you working now for the United Press International? You need to start writing some major articles.
Because no one will hire me, Helen.
Why?
Because nobody wants to hear this. And nobody wants to pay this. What's left of the American media is a joke. What's left of the American media is run by Harvard MBAs who will fire every journalist because they have to pay them a salary. There is no United Press International anymore. There's the label out there. And if you go to the website, all you'll find is a bunch of... I'm not exaggerating. You will find lots of strange little featurey articles by pimply students which are stuck in there to fill the space and make it look full. And they also take 200 or 300 words which are rewritten from other published sources perfectly legally, but they're just, basically, they have people in Bangalore, India, who they can pay $5 a head for to rewrite 100
words. But Martin, why don't you
BBC?
Why aren't you writing for the New York Times or Washington Post? I read the New
York
Times.
Because they never have me.
Why?
And they never would.
Why?
Because I didn't come up to Columbia School of Journalism.
Yeah, but they published my...
Georgetown for the previous 20 years now. That's all that matters in American
media. Martin, they published my article in the New York Times the other day.
But Helen, you're a Nobel laureate, dear.
I'm not. I formed
you created an organization that won the prize.
Yeah, that's true.
It wouldn't be there but for you.
I should really call myself a Nobel laureate, shouldn't I?
Yes, of course you should. And I'll tell you also why, because in modern America, nobody does anything. All that matters is claiming that you did things.
Oh.
What you do doesn't matter.
Oh, you're allowed
to
claim it.
Where you have been matters. It was brought home to me a year or two ago. I had a friend who had a very fine, eminent career in the National Institutes of Health. And his son was about 35 years old. The father is a wonderful man. And the son was a rather full of himself fellow. And I asked him at a reception we were both at to make a conversation. What do you do? 35 years old. He'd never held a job, and he spoke with great pride about getting this degree from Princeton and this degree from Indiana and this and that, and having interned with this senator or that senator. And he'd never actually done anything. He was defined, as so much of modern and professional America is, he was defined not by what he'd done, but by the different rubber stamps he had on his resume.
Well, that just TV. Goes to show. Well, Martin, we've run out of time. I think we need to get together, and I think you need to be leading the charge in the American media, educating people about how damn close we are to annihilation and why.
I would do so, but nobody will listen to me either on the conservative right or the liberal left.
Oh, yeah, but, you know, those are just labels. It's all so stupid. We're all human beings at heart.
But if there's anyone you think would use me in your own network of connections, by all means, connect me to them.
Martin, my love, I'll keep you in mind. And we're going to end now. So, Martin, thank you very much. It's been absolutely fascinating. I must say that when we meet and have lunch together in an Indian restaurant, I mean, I walk out dizzy in the head because you're so full of the most fascinating information that I've never thought of before. So, Martin Seif, thank you very much once again for a dizzying, fascinating interview.
Helen, a pleasure.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
My guest today on If You Love This Planet was Martin Seif, Chief Global Analyst for the daily online magazine The Globalist. Martin, for the past decade, has been the chief news analyst for United Press International and its former managing editor for international affairs. Thank you once again for listening. I hope you find this has been a fascinating program. Just tune in to Martin's Irish accent and all will be well. We look forward to speaking with you again next week, and keep your ear close to the ground. Things are happening in the world which you absolutely must know about, including Fukushima. Go to my website, nuclearfreeplanet.org, and catch up with all the latest. Talk to you next week. Bye for now.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.